Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a psychosis conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Psychosis is a collection of symptoms that affect the mind. It's when a person's thoughts and perceptions are not consistent with reality. Here's some examples. My patient was brought into the hospital by her boyfriend because she was not acting right. This 29-year-old woman was not making eye contact with me, turning her head to the side and mumbling to herself. I recognize this behavior as someone who is hearing voices inside their head. I saw she had fresh cuts on her arm. Her boyfriend told me that she stated that cutting herself would save him. He didn't quite understand that. I examined her further and noticed cuts on her neck. That was a game changer. Now I had to call our trauma team to evaluate her neck, as well as our psychiatric team. I medicated her to decrease the voices in her head and admitted her to the hospital. She was suffering from cannabis-induced psychosis. In another case, a 19-year-old was brought to the emergency department on a psychiatric hold. He called 911 on his parents because he thought they were going to kill his brother. He was seeing bags of blood, and he drove frantically from Northern California to San Diego to save his brother. At the same time, the young man's father called 911 because his son was acting erratically. This man, too, had cannabis-induced psychosis. He was seeing bags of blood and believed his brother was in danger, all which was in his mind, but not true. Bryn Spacer, the young woman from Thousand Oaks, convicted of involuntary manslaughter, described hearing voices that told her to keep on stabbing. She had to keep herself alive by stabbing, and that's what the voices told her. They egged her on to keep going to get herself back to life. She stabbed her boyfriend 108 times, killing him, stabbed her dog and herself. Bryn reminds me of my recent patients. I get frustrated when I read in the newspaper that such events are unusual. They're not. We see cannabis-associated psychosis on a daily basis in hospitals. There may be reluctance from physicians to make the diagnosis, but that reluctance simply robs patients from a diagnosis that could be reversible if caught in time. I saw the same reluctance from physicians with the opioid prescription epidemic. It's unpleasant to confront patients and a lot easier to just say nothing. But that type of silence costs lives. Parent victims of children who had cannabis-induced psychosis often say, "If I only knew." To learn more about cannabis and psychosis, I reached out to Dr. Andre McDonald. Dr. Andre McDonald is an epidemiologist and postdoctorate fellow. His research focuses on the intersection between mental health and addiction among youth. Currently, his primary interest is understanding the link between youth cannabis use and the risk of mood, anxiety, and psychotic disorder. To learn more about Dr. Andre McDonald, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Andre McDonald, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you for having me.
I'm very excited. Actually, it makes it fun to have a podcast because the way I got to you is I got a paper that you wrote and I thought it was really remarkable. I screenshot your graph and I started using it in my presentations and I thought, you know what? I should meet this guy. And here you are.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it's an interesting paper. We found some interesting results with it.
Right. So, I changed it because I used to say psychosis, the risk of psychosis is fivefold. But now I change the number from 5 to 11 for ages 12 to 19 based on your research.
Yes.
But I want to get into that. But before, your profession. You are an epidemiologist. What is that?
So the textbook definition of an epidemiologist is someone who studies the determinants and results of adverse health states, basically. So looking at an exposure and its relationship with an outcome. That would be the classic epidemiologists, what they kind of do on a day-to-day. So what I'm focused on is looking at cannabis and its association with mental health outcomes. So in a nutshell, that's what an epidemiologist does.
And when you were a little kid, did you say, I want to grow up and be an epidemiologist?
I had no idea what I wanted to do when I was a kid. This was something, I kind of fell into it. I found a job in public health and I just got really interested in it. I always had an affinity for math and quantitative things. So it was just a natural fit for me.
Yeah. So yeah, math and public health together.
Yeah, that's what Epi is basically. Yeah.
So you work for, I got the name of the center that you're working for. It says Addiction Research for Medical Cannabis. And I'm wondering what that is. And I guess what I'm really getting at is they call it medical cannabis. Is it really medical cannabis? Or what is that? Or is there a bias even in that name?
That's the name of the center. I think that's the focus of a lot of the research that's done there. I would not say it's a biased center. It's very kind of just pro data, pro science, doesn't have an agenda either way. It's kind of trying to figure out what are the possible benefits of cannabis and what are the risks associated with cannabis. So medicinal is in the name, but it looks at all aspects of cannabis, I would say.
I guess when I hear medicine as a physician myself, is I think of something that's approved by the FDA. And I'm sure in Canada, you have your own equivalent to FDA. And marijuana is not FDA approved, whether people call it medicine or not, unless it's Epidiolex, which is CBD, or Marinol, which is THC. So there are medications that I can prescribe that are FDA approved that come from the cannabis plant, but the plant itself is not FDA approved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the medicinal aspects of cannabis is not the focus of my research. That a lot of other people at the center are doing that kind of research. So yeah, I don't have much to comment on that.
Okay. All right. So, and what about, and I don't know if you can compare, but attitudes of marijuana in Canada compared to the rest of the world or the United States?
Well, I'm not sure about attitudes, but I mean, Canada has some of the, especially in youth, has some of the highest rates of cannabis use. So clearly people are, you know, more welcoming towards it. Youth, especially, really between 20 and 24 years old, that's the peak cannabis use years. And Canada, you know, compared to other countries, the US is similar to Canada. But really North America, those are some of the highest rates that we see in the world.
Okay. And what made you want to study this specific issue of in cannabis?
I mean, it was really the context of legalization in Canada. It was kind of, you know, we were the first G7 country, the second country in the world to legalize cannabis. And it's just a really, you know, there's so many unknowns with cannabis that it was a really fertile area of research. So I wanted to, you know, study the risks associated with it, especially from a public health perspective. You know, we're legalizing cannabis. That could send the signal to youth that it's, you know, a benign substance. But there's, you know, there's enough research out there suggesting that it actually is associated with risks. But how much it's associated and whether those associations are causal, that's still to be determined. So those are some of the questions that I'm trying to answer and are still unanswered.
So did you kind of like, okay, wow, this is legalized. There's going to be some serious public health implications, and I'm going to actually get the epidemiology to show that.
Yeah, exactly. And it was given that, Canadian youth were already, before legalization, some of the heaviest users of cannabis. There's a huge concern, and we'll talk about my paper in a bit, but the mental health effects of cannabis use during youth are potentially substantial. So understanding that relationship is from a public health perspective, a really high priority.
Great. Well, I'm really glad that there are people like you who have done that, who got the research. So there are all these things that we're thinking, like, well, this is going to happen, but you actually have the data and the numbers to show that.
Canada has some of the best data for it because we have a public health, universal healthcare system. It allows us to look at some of these relationships in a really robust way. And we'll talk about the paper in a bit.
No, yeah, let's talk about it. It's NBC News, May 2024. Teens who use marijuana are more likely to suffer psychotic disorders, published in Psychological Medicine. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the study was basically looking at youth aged 12 to 24. We asked them, or a survey asked them, about their cannabis use, about other types of drug use, and then we followed them for up to 9 years, and we looked at whether those who use cannabis were more likely to develop psychotic disorders or be diagnosed with psychotic disorders. And what we found was, and this was a bit surprising to us, was that there was a really strong association in adolescence. So from age 12 to 19, we found that cannabis use was associated with 11 times higher risk of psychotic disorders compared to teens who weren't using cannabis. But then in young adults, which was from age 20 to 33, we didn't find a significant association. And that was a bit of a surprise to us, because you kind of expect, even in young adulthood, the brain is still developing. But certainly in adolescence, it's developing at a much faster rate. So this was sort of some epidemiologic evidence to support neurodevelopmental theories that we had, but we didn't really have strong evidence in humans to support that.
So tell us, back up a little bit, and tell us about this survey. Like, how many people get this survey? Is it kind of like the surveys we have in the United States called Monitoring the Future and the National Survey on Drug Use and Health?
I don't know too much about them, but it's run by the Canadian government. Statistics Canada is sort of our national center for statistics, and they do this survey every year. It's a large survey. So we had it from 4 years of the survey, and we pooled youth age 12 to 24 just in Ontario, and that gave us a sample size of 11,000. But the survey itself in any given year is, I think, it's much larger than that. I think it's probably 70,000 every year. But 11,000 to look at this question is quite a large sample size.
All right. So you got the question and the 11,000 people, so you knew about their marijuana use. And how did you find out whether they had psychosis or schizophrenia or some other mental health problem?
So we linked the survey data with health service utilization data. So as I was saying earlier, Canada has a universal healthcare system. So anytime you interact with a doctor, that's coded for whatever reason the visit was for. So we looked at any diagnosis related to a psychotic disorder. It's important to note, we excluded cannabis-induced psychosis. So we were more looking at the onset of chronic psychotic illness in this paper. So essentially, or the outcome of psychotic disorders was visiting a family physician or hospitalizations or emergency department visits.
Did it include bipolar?
No, that was looked at when we looked at mood and anxiety disorders. I did a separate paper related to that. We didn't separate out bipolar for that study though.
Okay, because it's interesting, because I see, as an emergency physician, I see like an acute type of agitation or psychosis associated with it. And you're right, it's not always differentiated. Some later the psychiatrist calls it one thing or the other, but we see, like, probably like you're seeing, different type of mental health exacerbations associated with cannabis.
Mm-hmm. So for the other paper that looked at, bipolar is classified more as a mood disorder, but it does certainly have overlap with psychotic disorders. For that paper, we had to combine mood and anxiety disorders. So we didn't really get at that granularity of bipolar disorders. It's kind of, doctors are not very good at separating between the two. They're very comorbid, and doctors are often lazy, and they just kind of, you know, they have a code for a common mental health problem, and they just kind of, you know, code it that way. So we had to combine them. We didn't, for that study, find...
Although I wouldn't call us lazy. It's just that we have to click. Sorry. It's like you have to click these buttons. And so what are you going to call it? Because it doesn't exactly fit, or I don't always have the information. So everything is psychosis, otherwise undifferentiated. You know,
it's yes. Yeah. I'm sympathetic, but yeah. but that's the nature of the data. So we had to combine it. For that study, we did find a significant association, but we didn't find nearly as strong an association. And for that one, we were actually able to look at the frequency of use. And it was a bit of a weird finding. We found that in the most frequent use group, so weekly or more, we didn't find a significant association. In the weekly or less cannabis use, we did find a significant association. So that was kind of, you know, if you have a causal relationship, you expect there to be this dose response relationship where the more you use, the, you know, the higher the risk of the outcome. But for that study, we didn't find that.
Okay. So what was the bottom line of that, the study with, this is the one with just a psychotic disorder?
So the one that I was just talking about was the mood and anxiety disorder. So the bottom line was there is an association, but it's not convincing. It's certainly, compared to the paper on psychotic disorders, much less convincing. Sort of doesn't support a causal relationship, if you will.
Okay. But for psychotic disorder, excluding cannabis-induced psychosis for ages 12 to 19, there was an 11-fold increased risk?
Correct. Yeah.
And that was very remarkable. That the graph that I screenshot from your paper is one that went like, this is for this age group, and then the other ones were kind of like flat lines.
Yeah, when you see it side by side, it's quite, it's a stark difference. And again, like, we can't prove causality in that relationship. We can talk about it more later, but, you know, there's limitations to the study. In terms of, you know, there were certain confounders, other variables that might otherwise explain the relationship that we couldn't control for.
Like what?
And we also couldn't. So the big ones were trauma, history of trauma, and genetics, and family history of psychotic illness, which are quite significant. We know that psychotic disorders are quite heritable. But it's a little, this gets into the chicken and egg aspect of it. It sort of, does cannabis lead to psychotic disorders, or is it the opposite, where people who have psychotic disorders, or at least psychotic symptoms, are more likely to use cannabis?
Yeah, but if they stop using, then those symptoms go away. So then you can kind of,
yeah.
That's one way of showing that it's, you know, the chicken and not the egg.
Yeah, that's true. So this is a really contentious thing. So I'm careful to acknowledge both sides of the argument. I think on balance, the evidence suggests a causal relationship. But really, without running a randomized control trial, you will never get to that level of evidence where even the skeptics will agree. So we're making public health recommendations based on imperfect evidence.
Get into that.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Let's get into your argument to that. Like, okay, well, I'll never be able to. Because that happened, 50-100 years ago with tobacco, right? We couldn't prove that tobacco really caused lung cancer or heart disease or even secondhand smoke. Like, please. And they used that. Are you familiar with the Bradford-Hill criteria for?
Of course.
Okay. So we've applied that to cannabis and psychosis. Don't you think that that kind of shows that that is a risk factor? And it's a causation, not just an association.
I mean, yes, for most of so they're called criteria. Bradford Hill, in the paper where he actually talked about them, is more cautious in saying it's more of like, these are generally indicative of a causal relationship, but it's not, it's sort of, people kind of misuse it a bit in calling them criteria, but that's, that on day one of epi school, they teach you about those criteria. The ones where the skeptics call into question whether it is a causal relationship, the big ones are temporality. It's really difficult to establish that cannabis use came before psychotic disorders. That's the biggest one. It's the chicken and egg is, people with.
But the problem.
So there are a lot of studies.
But that's true for, if you look at the DSM-5 book, right? And you open it up and you need to make the diagnosis of whatever mental health disorder. They always say you have to exclude drugs, right? So you can't make the diet. You have to have someone off the drugs if you want to make a pure diagnosis. That's why you get these funny codes that you said the doctors don't want to do. It's because we don't really know. That's why. So you have to have somebody off the drug, show that they're okay, that their disease is not reversible by getting off drugs in order to make commit them to a permanent diagnosis of schizophrenia, for example. And that's not always possible. I think that's what you mean. But sometimes it is, especially if you catch it early.
But it's all self-reported. It's sort of, when they were young, it's possible that they had prodromal symptoms where it's sort of the early stages of psychosis. And I'm kind of playing devil's advocate. I agree with you. But these are some of the arguments that are, sort of call into question whether it is causal. And it's a really high bar that people set in order to call it that. But public health-wise, in my opinion, there's definitely strong enough evidence, especially for teens. And my recent study kind of really, highlights this. I think there's enough evidence for us to recommend to teens that they probably should delay or avoid use of cannabis.
Right. And the problem with that, with the thought, it's like, oh, well, we can't think of the chicken or the egg, is it trickles down to the clinical behavior of the doctor, psychiatrist with the patient, because it's hard to confront. It's hard to confront people with their drug use. And, but if you don't intervene, then you're like, okay, well, you have psychosis. It'll probably be pre-prevalent. And you don't give that, especially a young person, an opportunity to like, if you stop this, this may be reversible. If you don't have that conversation, then you've committed that person for a lifelong history of mental illness when you could have intervened early in their life and prevented it.
Yeah. So there's definitely research suggesting that it exacerbates psychotic symptoms in people who have already developed it. But it's sort of, if we're talking about the onset of it and whether cannabis use precedes it, talking about reducing cannabis after already having psychotic symptoms doesn't really get at the question of which came first. It's certain, like if teens get off of cannabis and their symptoms improve, that's, sort of supports causation, but it's still not getting at which came first, which is again, the criteria that we were talking about for a causal relationship, you would want to see that. And really, the only way to definitively establish that is with a randomized control trial.
But we never had randomized control trials with tobacco, right? Did we?
Yeah.
Did we wait for randomized control trials with tobacco, or before we finally like?
Yeah, I've thought about this question a lot, and it is, especially in the early history of that relationship. I think the biggest difference is that tobacco is killing people, and a lot of people were using cannabis, and a lot of people were dying. Cannabis and psychosis is still a pretty rare outcome. So it's, on, you know, public health-wise, it's not having the same impact as lung cancer was. It could be argued.
But is it true, or is it just that we have the benefit of watching the history of tobacco, but in the early days, nobody was dying of
it? Yeah.
Right. And now I could tell you that we're not measuring well the cannabis and psychosis overlap, at least in the United States. I don't know if Canada is doing a better job. And I think years from now, we'll see it more. It'll look like the problem's gotten worse. And it's because I've seen this happen with opioids, where it seems like the problem is worse, but the problem's not worse. It's just that we're recording it. We're doing a better job of recognizing the disease.
There are a lot of parallels. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we have a lot. I take to opioid prescriptions and tobacco in learning from, you know, what's happening with cannabis. But I'm telling you people that already have a problem. I think what your research definitely shows is the serious risk factor and prevention measures. Right. So not everybody who smokes is going to get lung cancer, but no one's going to argue that tobacco is a risk factor for lung cancer and heart disease. And I think the same thing we can say with cannabis. I mean, if you smoke, I don't know, maybe you'll get psychosis, maybe you won't, but it's definitely a risk factor.
Yeah. And I should have mentioned earlier, I'm finding myself kind of playing devil's advocate in this, but in this study, we did exclude people who were diagnosed with a psychotic disorder before we asked them about their cannabis use. And that was specifically to actually eliminate that possibility of reverse causation. But it is still possible that they had psychotic symptoms, but didn't, you know, go to a doctor for a psychotic illness before they used cannabis. But I agree with you on the big points, and the parallels with smoking and lung cancer are very relevant. I think I even mentioned it in the paper. So yes, in 20 years from now, it's possible that we'll be talking about this in a different way, certainly.
So the question is, how much of a risk factor? And this is why I screenshotted, you know, that graph in your paper, because I used to quote Dr. Marta De Forte's study from Europe that showed that if you use cannabis high potency on a daily basis, you have a fivefold risk force. So I now like took out her graph and now quote your graph, which is 11-fold for ages, you know, 12 to 19. So is that correct?
That's correct. And
that's huge. That's huge.
It's a huge number. In my years of being, I haven't been an epidemiologist that long, maybe 7 years, but it's the largest effect size that I've ever seen. When I ran the numbers, I was very surprised at the strength of that association. It's a few of the possible reasons, and I kind of talk about this in the paper. Number one, this study, compared to most previous studies, used more recent cannabis use data. And we know that cannabis has increased in potency quite dramatically. In Canada, it's similar in the US, but in the 80s, it was about, on average, 3% THC. And then the latest that I've seen was 2018, when cannabis was legalized, and it was over 20% in Canada. So that's a huge increase. It's basically a different product.
Yeah, different drugs.
Was telling me, you know, his generation, when they were smoking cannabis, that they were smoking leaves. So it was just like, it's a very different product that youth are using today. That's a possible reason. The others were, so this study used a clinical diagnosis. Most previous longitudinal studies, so, you know, looking at it over time, have used psychotic symptoms, which is a much lower threshold. It sort of, it doesn't speak to dysfunction in people's lives. So a diagnosis is much more relevant to public health. And that could partly explain why there's a stronger association. And then the third, I have to remember now. Yeah, I guess it's the age-dependent aspect. So if we were to average the association from adolescence all the way to young adulthood, it would basically flatten the association. So it was about double the risk if you were to not look at it separately. But when you do separate it, there's this really strong association in adolescence and no significant association in young adulthood.
Interesting. So, and you're excluding cannabis-induced psychosis. So if you included that, they would be even higher.
I didn't look at that. It's possible, but I would be speculating. If I had to guess, yes, but I can't say with any certainty.
Right. And comparison to the European study of DeForte that showed a fivefold increased risk, they were defining high potency as more than 10%, again, because it's an older study. And you were mentioning, okay, we're now at, you know, 28%. So again, a different product. So that makes it, you know, that's why there's such a, you know, basically double than what the Europeans said. The risk is more than that. And I'm wondering if you probably weren't able to tell about edibles versus smoked. We often get the question is like, is one safer than the other?
Yeah. So in this study, it was just, we asked them, did they use cannabis? And if it had been in the past year, it didn't unfortunately go into the different kinds of products, but that is a hot topic in the cannabis research space is looking at the different types of products and their various effects. But yeah, this study couldn't look at that.
What is your thoughts on that? Do you think it's smoked versus edibles or versus just dose? Like how many, you know, milligrams are you getting from smoking versus how many milligrams are you getting for depending how many bites of the cookie or the vapes and shatters?
My understanding of the biological process that kind of explains the relationship between cannabis and some of these outcomes is pretty limited. If I had to guess, based on my limited knowledge, I think it's probably more to do with dose. And, you know, flower generally has high THC these days. A lot of edibles are high in CBD versus THC. Not always, but that's sort of, it's more CBD oriented. So yeah, if I had to guess, I think it's more to do with THC than anything.
Right. I mean, California, the edibles like 5 milligram per dose, 100 per package. So it still could be high, very high, even higher than smoking. If you eat the whole package.
Yeah, that's a package. Lot. Yeah. That's different than Canada. I think Canada has a 10 milligram limit, I believe.
Yeah. Interesting. So do you have a theory of why this is happening? My only explanation, simple explanation to people is that THC is a fat soluble molecule and a very fat part of your body is your brain. So it sticks around there. But is there, do you have more of a theory on the endocannabinoid system of why that's so associated with psychosis?
So yeah, again, that's not my area of expertise. I'm an epidemiologist. I know I can crunch the numbers, but when it comes to, you know,
the math
position, so you would know, yeah, I'm the math guy. So I can't really comment on that. What I've read is it has something to do with the endocannabinoid system. And that's developing rapidly in especially in adolescence. And it THC exposure during that period has some sort of effect. But beyond that, I can't really comment.
All right. So your research is on in Ontario and show this, you know, 11-fold increase. Is it different in different provinces in Canada? Like, I know Quebec has been really probably leading in cannabis prevention and preventing candies and protecting youth more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Quebec has been different on a lot of fronts. They don't allow homegrown planting of cannabis. The age of purchase, legal age of purchase, is different. It's 21 in Quebec versus 19 in most provinces. It's 18 in Alberta, but 19 in pretty much every other province. And then, yeah, they have different rules on edibles. I don't know that in depth, but I do know that some of the rules that they put in place have contributed to less cannabis edible poisonings among youth. I have seen those data.
Yeah, that's one way of protecting kids. How did this research affect you? Like, you're running the numbers and it's like, holy, 11-fold difference. This graph is way, you know, did I make a mistake? And then you're crunching the numbers and you're like, no, this is real.
Yeah.
How did that affect you and your attitude?
I had to quadruple check everything because I was just so skeptical that it would be that strong of an association. But eventually I had to kind of just believe the numbers after I had checked it, you know, hundreds of times. But how did it affect me? It suggested to me that the association was stronger than I previously thought, I guess. That was the big change resulting from this study was sort of, oh, this is like a really strong association and it's specific to adolescents. I hadn't really seen that much research, strong research saying that. I don't know if it affected me, but it sort of changed my perspective on this relationship a bit.
So did it, like, you know, did you go home to your, I don't know, cousins or young people in your life and say, hey, you better be careful? Or I don't know if you're a dad or want to be a dad one day, yeah, that you're going to talk to your kids and say, you need to be careful, not do this or prevent things.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. I've told my family about it. I told my sister, who has two young boys, about my findings. And, you know, they're very young still, but when they're teens, I think this research, you know, I'm going to be hard on them to say, don't try not to use cannabis. It brings into play a lot of risks. So, yeah, you know, if you can delay your use or avoid it. That's what I would say to them.
Actually, you could say it now and in an age appropriate way, right? Because we prevention.
They're 4 and 2.
So yeah. It might be so like when we, like when my kids were that young and people would lit a cigarette, I'd be like, that's yucky. You don't want to do that. Cat can make your lungs black, you know? You know what I mean? You start young and in an age appropriate way, you could, and it's like, you know, when you smell that in the street, it's like, that's the stuff that daddy, you know, researched, you know.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, I'll try to pepper that in.
You could use that. So you also have done other research like the effect of legalization on youth use. How did that pan out in Canada?
So in terms of cannabis use, most of the big effects have been among adults. So they're pretty consistently in Canada, post-legalization, there have been increases in the prevalence of cannabis use among adults. It's a bit weaker for young adults and youth, but there was a recent systematic review that kind of went into this and did suggest that it has also increased in youth. It's a little less convincing than adults. Adults has been a really strong increase. If and so I would say for youth, it's probably a modest increase, if anything.
And how about driving? I think that's another area of your research, of driving under the influence of cannabis.
So I haven't looked at it in the context of legalization, but sort of the research that I have done on this, on cannabis and driving, was mostly to do with perceptions of it and whether it was associated with actually engaging in the behavior of driving under the influence of cannabis. And not surprisingly, if you viewed it as safe, you were more likely to engage in that behavior. If you perceived it to be less risky in terms of legal consequences, that was another sort of predisposing factor. But I haven't looked at whether driving under the influence of cannabis has increased since legalization, so I can't answer that question.
Interesting. So now, where is your research taking you? What are your next steps? Where are the numbers heading?
Where are the numbers leading me? Well, the big one is, so some of the confidence intervals in terms of the psychotic study were relatively wide, and that's sort of a product of not having a large enough sample. So I'm planning to do a study that pools a larger number of youth and basically redoing the study where we'll have, you know, 5 to 6 times the sample size. And that will sort of narrow the confidence intervals. It'll make us more confident in what the effect estimate is. For the 11 number that we were talking about, that teens who use cannabis are 11 times more likely to develop psychotic disorders, the upper limit of that was quite high. I think it was in the 30s. So that means that it's possible that the relationship is much, much stronger. So if we can narrow that, we can sort of better communicate to youth what, you know, what the actual risks are.
Can we just say, explain the confidence interval issue here? So when we're saying 11, we're saying the 11-fold risk of having psychosis with cannabis use for, you know, that age group of 12 to 19. Correct. The confidence interval, it means it could be up to 30 times or could be as little as,
yeah,
little
basically
as 5.
Yeah. And the lower limit is the one that people probably will focus on more. For the 11 number, I think it was around 5. So even then, that's a really strong association. We did sensitivity analyses where we basically redid the model, but changed a few things. For one of the models, we excluded outpatient visits, and the strength of it. So the estimate was 27 for that one. The lower limit was about 8, and the upper limit was 92.
Oh my gosh!
Which is really strong. Like, I've never seen numbers like
for smoke and head to the ER, right?
Yeah, for hospitalizations and ED visits, it was really strong. So yeah, that's certainly concerning. For that one, we did do a follow-up thing where we actually looked at of the teens who were diagnosed, you know, who were hospitalized or visited the ED, what proportion of them had previously used cannabis according to the survey, and we found that 5 and 6 of them had, which is, you know, just astounding. That's basically all of them, which is, yeah, if you want arguments for causation, that certainly suggests a really strong association.
Yeah, I don't think you could get stronger than that.
It would be difficult to, but those numbers are comparable actually to smoking and lung cancer. It's about 85% of lung cancer cases are attributable to smoking, when last I read the studies on that.
So the way you're going to do the study again and make it bigger, are you going to other counties? Are you going beyond Ontario? Or
yeah. So for this other study, we're going to be looking nationally. When we go nationally, we won't have outpatient visits, but that's a technicality. So for this study, we're going to have probably over 1 million Canadians. So it's going to be a huge study. and it will be specific to hospitalizations, which still captures, in fact, hospitalizations are more, we can be more confident that it is a psychotic disorder. Outpatient sort of muddies it a bit. The specificity of that diagnosis is a bit reduced when it's, you know, outpatient visits, but hospitalizations, very confident in those results. So with a million Canadians, that won't be just youth. We'll be looking across the life cycle because, you know, it's possible that we'll find something interesting in older adults. But with that large of a sample, we'll be able to really, you know, get closer to what the real number is.
And again, the reason that your numbers in Canada are so much higher than what the studies are in Europe, I think, is the time, right? Those studies in Europe are older, yours are newer, and so therefore your products are more potent. So, and that could explain such a big difference between the 5-fold risk in Europe and the 11-fold risk in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. And I have read that in general, North America has higher potency cannabis than Europe. Not significantly, but, you know, enough that it could also make a difference. But I think the bigger thing is that time has passed and cannabis potency has increased over time. So it's that could explain why the association is stronger.
That's great. Okay, so I'll be looking out for your million patient research. When do you think that'll be coming out?
That could be sometime. I have some other projects on the go right now, but that will probably be in a couple years, I would say.
All right, I'll be looking for that. That'll be newer data. What are the other things that you're working on?
Yeah, so some of the papers right now, one of them is looking at the impact of legalization on the different cannabis markets. So over the first 5 years of legalization in Canada, what sort of happened to the illegal market, what happened to the medical market, and what happened to the overall market. And for that paper, we found that, not surprisingly, legal sales took over a huge proportion of the market. I think it was 72% at the 5-year mark was legal sales. Illegal cannabis, not surprisingly, again, cratered. Basically, it went from 88% to, I think, 11% of the overall market.
Oh, interesting, because in the United States, you know, having legal market just made the black market proliferate more.
Yeah,
interesting.
I can't explain the differences. I mean, Canada has taken a public health approach, maybe more than, I don't really know. The prices have become more competitive legally for the legal products compared to the illegal products. That's probably the biggest.
And maybe is there deterrence? There's still deterrence for the illegal market, right? There's law enforcement closing down the illegal shops, maybe more. I don't know.
I think it's. There's sort of a tolerance policy at this point, if I had to guess. I think it's more to do with competitive pricing. I don't think people are, you know, there's no fear of, you know, getting caught with cannabis because it's now legal. So it's sort of, if you're buying cannabis or if you're getting it from a friend, that's, you know, it's a gray area. You know, it could be a gift to a friend. So it's, I don't know. The technicalities of that are a little unclear.
And then you were saying the medical market?
Yeah, so for the medical market, we saw leading up to legalization was increasing, and then at legalization, it just flattened. So it didn't continue its upward trajectory. So that's sort of, we're assuming that legalization reduced the market a little bit, but not nearly as much as the illegal market. But the bigger finding, I would argue, is that the overall size, so when you combine illegal, medical, and legal into one number, the size of the overall cannabis market has increased substantially. So in the first 5 years, it increased about 75% in size in terms of how much people spent on cannabis, which is concerning from a public health perspective, because that kind of suggests more people are using cannabis, or people who were using cannabis are using more. So that's concerning.
Interesting. I'm wondering, I'm just going to throw this out for you, for big studies that need associations, is the American Heart Association has a white paper that really shows the risks of cannabis use in heart disease, heart attacks, high elevated blood pressure, stroke. And there are some studies on that. And I'm wondering, because you were saying, you know, looking at adult use, you're not seeing it in mental health. I'm wondering if you're seeing it in cardiac disease.
I haven't looked at that, but I have been following that story. So I did see that study that was published. It's so early in the science for that question. There's like a handful of studies, but that one found a significant result. So it's certainly, you know, it's worthy of more research. We need to be looking at that more. It's plausible that, you know, particulate matter from smoking cannabis would affect the lungs and heart. So, you know, it makes sense at a certain level. It's difficult to separate out what tobacco kind of explains in that relationship.
Yeah. Actually, they've done studies that exclude tobacco. They've done studies that exclude tobacco as far like just cannabis smokers and tobacco smokers and looking at the lung. Again, this is not big. Yeah. This is not big epidemiological studies, and they saw that the lungs look worse for cannabis users than tobacco, which makes sense clinically because you're like inhaling longer.
Yes, and you don't have good filters.
Yeah.
Often, so it's it's a different. There's probably more per joint versus per cigarette. There's more. You're being exposed to more particulate matter. Yeah.
Yeah. We're definitely seeing that in the emergency department, the lung effects. And that just makes sense, right? You're smoking anything is not good for you, no matter what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's all very interesting. Congratulations to you. I love your math and public health approach. And Uncle Andre, don't be afraid to talk to your nephews when you see a billboard out there and saying that's what uncle studies, it's not healthy, you know. They'll remember that.
I'll give it a shot.
All right, anything else we need to know about cannabis epidemiology in Canada?
I think I've covered the big points. It's, you know, the take-home message is and I think a lot of parents don't know this, and so that is something I guess I want to highlight, is like I was saying earlier, a lot of parents, when they were teens, the cannabis was a fundamentally different product, and today and into the future it's the trajectory is of THC potency is increasing. So the take-home message is this is not the same product that you were using when you were kids. And you know, if you want to use the precautionary principle, you should probably tell your kids to avoid cannabis use until they're older, or if possible, just to avoid altogether.
Yeah. Protect your brain from tobacco, alcohol, drugs, at least till age 20.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. It's very common sense, but yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Andre McDonald. Thank you so much for your research and taking the time to join us on High Truths. And I'll be looking forward to your future publications.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'll be thinking about you whenever I show that slide. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truth's producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.